Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast focused on Kenpo, but we also cover the other martial arts when so needed. I am Reggie Darden, and quite excited to have our great guest on today. So we got Brittany Tatum on, and we're gonna just talk some Kenpo and kind of go from there. I typically start things off by just kind of giving a little bit of my background so that the guest is kind of familiar with me. So I started in the early to mid-90s in Kenpo right after seeing The Perfect Weapon, a little movie I don't think anybody's heard of.
Not at all. You know,
I saw Mr. Speakman and his great Kenpo moves, and I said, I got to do that. So signed up and, just got right into training. I trained for about 2-3 years, almost got to my third brown when I left for the Army. And, while I was in the Army, I got to do a little bit of Taekwondo and Hapkido and some boxing. And, did that for a few years. When I got out of the military, I couldn't find a school that really suited my needs. So I just kind of did my own thing, kind of, tried to remember all my techniques and such from before. The school that I started at was essentially under the Tracy's curriculum, Tracy's Kenpo curriculum.
Beautiful.
So when I, just kind of did my own thing until I found the art of capoeira. And just got all involved in that. Saw another movie, Only
yes.
the Strong, and that much like Kenpo, it hooked me right away, and I had to do that. So I started doing capoeira, and as of this recording, I'm coming up on 17 years doing
nice.
That. So. It's been a fun journey, not only learning, but I ended up inheriting the group that I was part of, and so I got thrust into the teaching side of it. So
that's the best.
Been kind of doing that as well, and just really enjoying that. But I always kept my love for Kenpo, and I decided that I needed to seek out a school. And Sensei YouTube was not getting it done for me, so hunted around and found a school that worked for me. And this particular school is under the Ed Parker American Kenpo,
sure.
So different curriculum than I started with. So much to my displeasure, I had to start over as a white belt, but. I was, I'm glad that happened. So, because I learned so much more now by learning the principles and and the terminology.
Right.
And just by the time I got my orange belt, I was like, man, I know so much more than I did, almost being a brown belt. So, so I was happy with that, and I've been training that, and. Just really enjoying it. Of course, I want to do a million other things,
sure.
But I've just been really, really working it and enjoying it. And also, as of recently, I've joined the instructors program at my school.
Nice.
And so, even though I've got to teach capoeira for a long time, teaching Kenpo is now something that. I'm learning about and getting my feet wet into that.
Oh, yeah.
And enjoying that. So looking forward to where that's headed, and we'll kind of talk about the teaching side of it in a little
sure.
bit. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So I will turn things over to you to fill us in on. Well, I guess this is a little different since, obviously you're the daughter of someone that Kenpo people may have heard
Am
of.
I?
So, it's kind of obvious, but how did Kenpo find you, and,
Sure.
and you know, how did it all get started, and yeah, fill us in.
Well, you know, as you know, my father is Grandmaster Larry Tatum, and my mother is also an eighth degree Dan. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the first fist I ever made, right, as a baby, and in fact, they have pictures. It was very strong. It was in perfect form, which was good. You know, Kenpo was something that my parents never forced upon me, right? So I grew up, obviously, in a dojo. You know, my home core memories that make me feel safe and like, oh, just like a warm blankie, are the smell of a gym, right? Like sweat, carpet mold, right, from the West LA school where my dad was, and
My first school, we had the shag carpet, and you know, before you even, you know, when you got to the end of the block, you knew, hey, there's a karate school down the street for sure.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I know the smell,
right?
Very
the smell
well.
Of a sweaty gi and the sounds, right? So the sounds of people working out hard, and the kiais, and the community, you know, like the feeling of being home, growing up in dojos, because students are more than just students, they become your family as well. And you get to know them, you get to know their stories. And so as a young child growing up in that, I got to hear those stories and be around those people. You know, like I knew Jeff Speakman as a really tiny person. And I count myself fortunate for that. And so, yeah, I was on the mats early, and that was before we had pads, right? So I was sparring, no pads, getting the wind knocked out of me, you know, learning where my power was, my kiai was, like what that felt like to have my butt kicked, right, and fall down and have to get back up and get back up. And it was wonderful. It was a confidence builder. Took some breaks growing up because, you know, teenage girl, right? So again, it was never thrust upon me, but I always was like, because it was home, I'd want to get back into it. So I had many instructors growing up into it. So I would go back in, you know, as 10 through 13, you know, get up to like purple and blue. Then I would take a break because I was running cross country, right? That time I was in high school. Went back to it when I was about 18 for a little while. Got up into green. Again, took another break. College. Went back in my 20s, like early 20s. Finally got up to second brown. And then I took a really long break. About 6 years or so, came back to it at 29 after a very messy divorce situation, you know, and I had been working in marketing and SEO for a long time. I went to school for graphics design and multimedia at the time, so I had been doing that for about 10 years, and I came back, and I was really in a place where I was soul searching. Like it was a wonderful place to be. I didn't have any belongings, so I left that relationship with $800 in a suitcase and landed back in Burbank, right, with my parents. And I knew that I wanted to do something different. I wanted to be of service, you know, because I knew that being of service was going to help me process the previous 6 years, you know, that break. So I was sitting at dim sum in Chinatown, right, with my parents, talking about what I was going to do next. And my dad was like, you know, like you're an incredible martial artist and you're an awesome teacher. Why don't you come teach for me? You know, I need a manager for the dojo. You have all of this corporate experience, project management, all of this. You can, you know, come and be a manager, and I need help with the social media and the website and, you know, social presence, all of that. And I said, sure. My friend looked at me and was like, you need to do this. And I was like, I know I do, because I knew that my strength, right, my confidence, all of those things were going to blossom by putting my roots into the soil of Kempo, of home. But I was, you know, scared out of my mind. I hadn't been on the mats in a long time. I hadn't taught in a long time. But my father and my mother, they had faith in me that the Kempo hadn't left me, right? Because it doesn't. Like, it gets in your DNA, you know? If you love the art the way I love the art, the way you imparted that you love the art, it's kind of like chocolate, right? Like, you can put it down for a while, but there's always that taste in the back of your mouth where, like, I got to have a piece of chocolate eventually, right? And
yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, before I started back up at the school that I'm at now, I mean, I was having dreams mm-hmm. About Kempo, and, you know, it's like, oh, like, tonight, it's like, oh, I'm leading a class, yeah. or, you know, I'm working on a drill, yeah. or... I'm a strange person. I even had dreams about, like, doing paperwork.
Sure.
And I'm very weird in that sense.
It's...
But, yeah, I, you know, kind of a streak of those kinds of dreams. And I was like, you know what? I've got to find a school.
You got to do it.
You know, not stop until I find something.
Yeah. And, you know, we all say, like, oh, you know, we took breaks, right? Like, we're apologizing for not being full-time martial artists all the time. Well, the fact of the matter is, we are full-time martial artists all the time. And even if we're not on the mats, more than likely, we're running drills in our head. We're laying awake at night going through form four. We're running our techniques, right? We're in a restaurant and we're looking at the exits and, like, our environmental awareness. You know, we're in a parking lot, we're doing it. So I don't think that people should apologize for breaks at all, because it's another... breaks are necessary, and life happens, and the art is so special in a way that is unlike anything else. Even if you're not on the mats, if you're thinking about it, you're training. And so more often than not, someone will come back from, you know, a 2-year, 3-year, 10-year break, and they're moving better, right? They're stronger, their stances are better. They may not remember the name of the techniques, but they're grafting, right? Their sparring is decent. So, anyway, yeah, just to say, always doing it.
Yeah, no, I like what you say about, you know, being that full-time martial artist and not apologizing for
right.
breaks. It's like something that I like to say is that, you know, we don't find Kempo. Kempo finds us. And we have, you know, It comes into our life at, you know, the point that it needs mm-hmm. to. So, like with me, there was a 25 plus year gap between my mm-hmm. Kempo schools, and, you know, as much as I would have loved to have continued training, you know, originally, you know, I'd be, you know, whatever, you know, big high black belt at that point in my life, that wasn't the right time for me to be there. I wouldn't have met the people that I
yeah.
would have met, you know, had I stayed. I wouldn't, you know, trained in the places that I mm-hmm. trained, or, you know, just be in those parts. So I look at now, and, you know, I love my school and my instructor, you know, so much that it's like, yeah, if things were different, I maybe wouldn't be here.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's
oh,
huge.
Totally.
So yeah, I just see it as Kempo wasn't ready for me at mm-hmm. that time, and, you know, now
yeah.
it is. So
it does. It shows up in the best ways. And I'm, you know, as a kid, I didn't appreciate it as much as I do now. Even in my 20s, right, with a partially developed brain, because, you know, your brain doesn't develop fully until it's like you're even 26. I was kind of a punk-ass kid, you know, like, totally didn't have appreciation for people or even know, like, who I was or where I was, you know, in the pattern, right, the universal pattern or life or whatever. Came back to it at 29 you know, in the circumstance that I was. And I felt this incredible sense of gratitude and humility. You know, it wasn't about rank. It was, and it's still not about rank, for me anyways. It's about the love of it, you know, and what it gives to people, right? And everybody's different, but oh my gosh, you know, what a wonderful thing to have, you know, 10, 12, I mean, I never stopped teaching, but at least in that dojo space, you know, a full decade of stories and seeing students light up and be successful and how the art trickles into every single aspect of their life. You know, the idea that, you know, I'm going to be a little philosophical here, but like, let's say, for example, you know, you're trying to help a student with their techniques and they're just not in the right angle or, you know, wherever they are, they're just struggling. And you look down at their stance and they're just a couple of inches off, you know, or they're just not quite in a forward bow. And you just adjust them a little bit. Well, then suddenly that little adjustment, right, it filters into all of their movements, all of the techniques. Suddenly, as an instructor, you don't have to fix 15, 20 different things, right? You fixed one tiny thing that's articulated all the way through their own pattern, like, and where they are in their reference point. And then you get to hear about how that's fixed so many things in their lives, right? That mental adjustment, that mindset adjustment. And that's what I find beautiful about it, you know? I mean, yeah, I love the science of motion. You know, I've been working on 8 lately, and talk about just incredible, eyes wide open, you know, aha moments. But yeah, you know, I rambled a bit there.
I like that. I like that. So, you know, you said that you weren't forced mm-hmm. into it, which is good. But, you know, obviously being who you are and your, you know, relationship, mm-hmm. do you think there was any kind of pressure, you know, to stick with it, or it's just always, you know, I want to do this for me? And
I would say that the pressure that I felt getting from brown to black was definitely pressure that I put on myself, you know, because I want to preserve the lineage of the teachings so badly. I believe in taking the time to learn the dynamics, to pay attention to form, to pay attention of your angles, you know, pay attention to your angles, and to not put everything into the what if phase, right? Because a lot of instructors do, you know, you teach delayed sword 10 different ways, right? And to a new student, if you're not giving them the block print, right, of the stepping back, the pinning, the strike, the kick, the hand sword, getting out of there. In my opinion, you're robbing them of the ability to create their own what ifs down the line, right? And so for me, the pressure that I put on myself back then and the same pressure that I put on myself now is preserving the block print, if you will, right, of the foundational aspects of the techniques, so that when I teach it, I'm giving my students the opportunity, right, to build their foundation without putting in, without putting in, you know, Brittany Doe, right, like my way. It's like, no, let's give it just to them, you know, let them figure out their own handwriting, you know, let them have their own meaningful dialogue down the road. But let's at least teach it the first time the exact way that it was meant to. Because Kenpo works if you have a solid foundation, right? And most of the time, when I see and I experience myself, it's like, oh, this technique doesn't work, or, you know, like, oh, it's an awkward one. Oh, dance of death, right? Like, I mean, I'm just under 5'4". So to give everybody context, I like weigh in at 144 and I am at like 5'4". So getting people down, right, was a struggle for me until I realized that my angle of incident was not feeding my proper, you know, angle of entry. Once I went back to the base technique and I looked at my alignment, and I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm really stepping in the wrong position. It worked. So that's the pressure I put on myself, right? Is every time I find a technique where it's awkward, or every time, you know, I hear somebody say like, oh yeah, but this wouldn't work, that is my cue to say, no, let's go back and see why it's not working, because it does, it's designed to, but you have to, A, you know, have instructors that are willing to say, oh, I didn't think of that. Like, I'm teaching it out of a what if phase. Let's go back to the ideal phase. And two, you have to kind of slow your ego down, right? And stop getting in your own way. Be willing to step out of the way, right? Again, patterns, being in the universal pattern, using it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So coming up, was there, so I kind of imagine, you know, when coming up in the, you know, lineage that, mm-hmm. that you're in, I kind of envision this, almost, I guess kind of Karate Kid, way of, oh, well, you're getting the, you know, the lessons, and it's like, okay, like, you know, go ahead and wash the dishes, and this is, you know, a Kenpo lesson in disguise. And so was there like a separation between, okay, like this is the, you know, our training in the studio, yeah. and then this is our, you know, our home life? Or was it kind of always, you know, you were kind of quote unquote always on as far as the training?
Always training on. Went. I mean, it always on, but like not in a, not like in a, like a comic who's always feeling that they have to be on and like wear that persona. We're martial artists, you know, we're like a modern samurai family. The Bushido code, the Kenpo code, right, or creed, doesn't end when you get off the mats, right? It becomes who you are. So, yeah, you know, conversations at dinner, because both of my parents are, you know, teaching and managing the association and doing seminars and all of that. I mean, I grew up listening to that, helping design the website for, you know, the private dojo and those things. I mean, yeah. And then there are, of course, like at-home moments, right? Like when you're cooking and you go in the spice cabinet and it falls and you catch it with your left hand. And you're like, ha-ha, you know, or you take out like a knife, right, to like cut something, and you're flipping it, right? You're in the kitchen, you're flipping it. Yeah, it's a dinner nice. Party and you don't realize it. And people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, yeah, never mind. I'll put the knife down.
I just loved it. And I'll, you know, mention this for the listeners. So she I love that you just had this a large knife just, I mean, automatically right there at the.
They're training knives. They're plastic, but yeah.
Still, I mean, without any hesitation, just
I did
pulled those right out. I was like, that is definitely a Kenpo person if ever. And I see.
We got a katana. Yeah, this is my. Goodness. This is my workstation where I do my regular work. You know, I'm a comms manager, and I. Because working with eight, all right, so let's give the listeners some context, because I don't just like run around with large knives or training knives all the time. very dangerous to do so. Don't do this at home. But when you're going from, you know, fists as weapons, right, or strikes as weapons to actual weapons, it's a different neural pathways that you have to build to translate, right, the motion into having the weapon, right, be a part of you in that strike. And for me, because, you know, like I'm double jointed, like articulation in my hands when I'm doing forms, and plus I've got this like finger that broke a while back that doesn't quite close. If people see me on the videos that my dad posts, you might see me milking the cow, right? So like kind of open fists, especially when I spar, right? I'm not a, obviously, like a closed fist fighter. Like I like to stay loose. Well, that's not going to translate well if you're holding on. You need to hold on to a knife, right? Or a baton or something like that. So the advice that my dad gave me when we started training eight, he's like, keep them with you. Like not in the car, right? We don't want to freak people out, but keep them with you. And like when you're working, you know, like pick them up, hold on to them, grab them, like get used to the motion of them and make them a part of you. So yes, training knives at my workstation.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. I got to step up my weapons game and get some more weapons around the house.
You don't have enough. So. Nice. Nice.
So I like that. So, as far as did you get into, you know, competitions?
I did not. By the time that I came back, I was happily leading other people into competitions. You know, like that was more important to me. It's like, how can I help them achieve? You know, because again, like rank and accolades and things like that, they've never been my focus. You know, I had such, God, my cup was so filled and it's still filled to this day by, you know, teaching people are like, hey, I want to go, you know, to the internationals. I want to take, you know, short three. Or, hey, I want to do something different. You know, I want to create like a fan kata. It's like, well, yeah, let's do that. Let's get into it. So that's more of what I was doing. Or sparring, right? Like training people on how to, be better at their sparring, be better at point sparring. There's a difference, obviously, between like street fighting, right? Using your kempo on the street. Sparring just in the dojo, and then competition point sparring. So those are definitely three different ways that you can train, and was really happy to see our students like go to those tournaments and achieve. You know, it was awesome.
Nice. So what was it like being, you know, I assume obviously there was a lot of, you know, big name people and celebrities and whatnot, you know, in your orbit. So, you know, did you ever kind of feel like, oh, like, you know, oh my God, like this person's here? Or was it just kind of always everyone's just, you know, oh, well, you know, that's such and such person and, you know, no big deal. Like they come over for dinner or whatever the case is and, you know, you just see them and, you know, all the rest of us are drooling and it's like, oh my God, you know.
Did it ever normalize? Absolutely not. But you keep your cool, right? Like Tim Roth is in the dojo teaching his kids. It's like, I totally made an idiot about myself with Reservoir Dogs, but you know, I couldn't help it. you give those celebrities like their space because they're there usually to either train, you know, for their roles. Or they're just trying to be parents, you know, they're just there, like, just teach my kids, you know, like, let me scroll my phone. Let me read my book. Like, this is my downtime, as a family person, like, just do that. But no, you fangirl moments. Oh my God. All over the place. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. No, I like to hear that. So, you know, I've been kind of surprised in, you know, doing this podcast that I've been a lot more controlled than I thought I would be. Of course, I did lose it for a few. I guess at this point, probably three people. So
okay, who?
you know, they're, come on. The episodes haven't been released yet, but Lee Wedlich, I was at a loss for words talking to him. Recently, I got to interview Jeff Speakman, and that was, that was a hard one to get through. I'm still kind of in shock that it was like, I was talking to Jeff Speakman, and like, he called me, and, you know, like, I'm not sure how to handle this.
You're doing great.
So that and Ed Parker Jr. As well. Yeah. I was kind of, you know, like, oh my God, this, you know, I don't even know what to say, but try and keep it together. But it's been, you know, we all put on our geese, you know, one leg at a time. Do. So
I jump into mine. No, I'm teasing.
Well, I mean, of course, like, usually just, you know, you just get up and they just automatically just kind of attach to you like a Iron Man, and you can just kind of summon them. And
I'm going to send you
materialize
on that, right? Because this is funny. So I needed a new pair of heavyweight black bottoms and got them, right? they were so starched, Reggie. And I took a video of it. It's hilarious. I cuffed them, and I drawstringed them, and I stood them on the ground by themselves. No joke. They were so starched that they actually stood on their own. And I took a video of it. I will send it to you. It was the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. Went to put them on, right? Forgot to just wash them first. I was like, whatever. Worked out. Scraped. Right? Those things were so rough that I actually had scrapes on my knees. Just speaking of geese, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Gee problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I had one like that at my first school. I think I was getting ready to take my green belt test, and I decided, I need to have a nice new crisp uniform.
Yes.
And, I made the mistake. I think they added an extra super to this gi because it was a monster. And you know, I probably worn it a handful of times before the test, and that was a mistake. I mean, it was already super heavy, and then, you know, by the time I, you know, get through all, you know, the techniques and the forms, and so at my original school, we had 40 techniques per belt. So doing the test, going through all
10 hours later,
all the basics, all the forms, I mean, I'm already just drenched in sweat. And then it's like, okay, now I got to fight like three fresh guys. And I just could not move. But, I was definitely scraped up that gi. There was like, you know, cheese graters on the inside of them, because I was
you need a rash guard for a new gi. I'm telling you, anybody listening, throw them in the dryer over and over and over again with rocks. Take them to a riverbed, you know. Exactly, let the rocks roll on them. It's ridiculous.
I decided I got a new gi a few months ago, and I learned my lesson about the super heavyweight ones, and so I guess I've got like a super medium.
Like a midweight.
It feels pretty heavy, but it's a good, you know, a good ratio between you know, having that crispness and still being, you know, functional. So I think that's going to be my thing to going forward, is just kind of stick with the middle and not go super heavyweight. Yeah. Maybe just for like photo shoots or something.
Oh, I know.
But
I like the heavyweights though for the armor aspect. I mean, you just, you know, I was doing four in my living room. You know, I had been doing yoga, right? And I was like, oh, I feel so good. Like, let's just run through four. And, oh, my goodness, I bruised my arm so badly. I was like, myself, right? That old adage, like, don't worry about fighting a Kenpoist. They fight themselves, right? Yeah. At least the heavyweights and the middleweights, like, protect you from that a little bit. But yeah, you still have to condition.
Exactly. So, so now that I am, you know, newly in the instructor life, I'm curious, if you could, talk a little bit about, first, your early experiences
sure.
teaching and, kind of what that was like, and then leading into kind of what advice you would have for someone like me or, people that are listening that may be new to instructing, what would a new instructor need, some tips for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could really and I know a lot of people seminar on just, how to instruct and what to do. Takeaways for me were, number one, right, teach the curriculum with the block print. And if you're unsure of where to step, if it's not working, take a minute, bow off the mat, go find somebody that does, or I use the app, right? Even in training now, I'll pop open the app, I'll pop open YouTube, I'll find my dad, and I'll be like, okay, what's going on here? Or I'll call him. But if you don't have any of that, have somebody that's going to be honest with you and give you the information you need to give back to your students. So that's number one. Never be afraid to bow out of a lesson for 5 minutes and get it right instead of allowing yourself, your ego, your embarrassment, right, your excitement or whatever to get in your way, because it's really about them. The more you pour into your students, the more you learn about the art, the more you learn about yourself. You learn your own pain points in teaching, right? So that's number one. Number two, listen to who they are, right? It's very easy as an instructor to get onto the mats because you're feeling good, right? You're already feeling confident. You're in your gi. You're in a position of influence. And you're like, oh, I get to mold these people, right? Keyword is get to. It is a gift. But it's not, in my opinion, an opportunity to fill someone's head with your way, right? It's an opportunity to learn who your student is and to show them the way. So instead of pontificating about how good you are or jumping to the ideal phase, but wait, look at what I can do, and I can teach you to do that too, right? It's not about hero worship. It's about giving your student the opportunity to be their own hero and then workshopping it backward, right? Engineering it from there backward, reverse engineering to what you can give to them. And then the third is don't talk so much, okay? Because you can get into an explanation of something. What is it? My partner just brought up Einstein. It's if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it. So if you find yourself going on a long tirade, stop. Do the art. Let them do the art. Let them ask the questions and then ask them, do you get it? What questions do you have for me? How can I help you succeed at this? Where do you feel this in your body? And for goodness sake, drop those stances. Drop them. Make your students sit in their stances. Get those knees bent. Get the weight distribution properly on the outside of the feet. Make them stretch into forward bows. Let them be uncomfortable in wide kneels. Run those drills. Have them drop. Because so often I see people and it's they're not marrying the uppercase with the lowercase or the middle case, right? Or hips or anything like that. And they won't have the power and the structure as a young student to be able to go into black successfully or even really be safe on the street, right? You're going to be off balance. Nobody's going to attack you while you're barefoot wearing your gi in front of your peers, right? Nobody's going to throw five swords and windmill at you and stop, right? They're going to go through you. You have to train that. So the other thing would be hit your students, develop meaningful dialogue. Obviously, don't plow through them they're not human. But give your students the opportunity to feel what it feels like to actually have some power behind the attacks and train them to be good ukes, right? Let them experience that too, because the more we can make it as real as possible in the dojo, right? Get out of our own way with the teaching, teach the block print, teach the art. Honestly, the safer our students are, right? Because we want them to be safe, we want them to be inspired, but give them the structure. So I will soapbox on that all day, Reggie, all day.
Oh, no, I like that. You hit on great points. I know number three definitely hit me because, yeah, I'm like the king of the rat holes. And my mind is always, I liken it to the show Family Guy, and they do all these kind of, you know, cutaways when they're doing jokes. And that's like my mind. I'll start talking about something, and then I'll get this like cutaway, you know, thing in my mind, and I'm like, oh, and then I gotta go, you know, talk about that. So yeah, that's a big one for me. And then the stances is a big one for me. You know? And I kind of chuckled at that because at my school, we, you know, every time, you know, the wide kneel, closed kneel comes up, it's like, okay, like we're gonna do this now, so just like, you know, deal with it. Like you need to do this, and you know, everybody's like, oh boy, here we go. Like, no, we don't want to do that, but yeah, that's something that's gotta be done. So
yeah,
I'm glad that you mentioned that.
Oh yeah, so
that's a good one. So the next thing, where kind of, you know, in your experience, what kind of things do you see for, you know, the future of Kenpo, or where would you like to see it go? You know, we don't want to get into, you know, all the drama and whatnot, but just kind of, you know, where would you like to see things go, or where do you see that maybe they're heading, you know, kind of with the things with like MMA and just kind of different ideas of kind of how Kenpo should, you know, is going. So some kind of what I was thinking about with kind of with this idea, I was talking to somebody and they mentioned something that I hadn't really thought about, but now we're getting to this point where there is, you know, less of a connection to Ed Parker because, you know, a lot of the people that were you know, with him are going, you know, everybody's time comes at some point. So now we're starting to get to generations where, you know, they don't have someone that was either, you know, directly connected to Ed Parker or even, you know, their teacher wasn't, you know, doesn't even really have a connection to Ed Parker. So kind of from my view, I feel like that's, we're getting to a point where there could be a kind of a significant change in Kenpo and how it's perceived and, you know, maybe how it's, you know, taught going forward. So I think that we maybe need to start kind of planting the seeds for like, hey, this is where we want to Kenpo to go and not be so fractured. And, you know, I mean, there's going to be drama and disagreements and stuff for until the end
it's
of time.
Family.
But I think we're closing into a position where we can, you know, maybe kind of help heal the Kenpo community a little bit. And
I have a lot of thoughts and feelings on that, and they're all positive. So, you know, the first thing that I would say is that the future of Kenpo is in everyone, right? Because the art chooses how to articulate itself and how to grow and how to inspire in each practitioner. So to say that the art needs to be a certain way would be to say, or it would be to, in my opinion, eliminate the opportunity for diversity and inclusion, right? That's not to say that for myself, right? I'll speak for myself. My intention for the Kenpo that I teach, you know, that my parents have taught, that was, you know, from what they learned from Ed Parker. My intention is to preserve that lineage. So my intention is to teach it correctly every time. and give that to the students so that they can teach it correctly every time. And so through that, you know, Parker, my dad, the other pioneers of Kenpo, they're going to live on and forward. They won't live on and forward if we keep augmenting the system to our way. Not to say that that's wrong. Okay, so we talk about, you know, again, Kenpo being in everyone. It is perfectly okay for it to be a tree, right? And on one branch, you've got Parker's system, my father, you know, those people on that branch, me, my partner. Cool. Like, you want to do it this way? Like, let's go over here to that branch. But then, you know, you have other amazing practitioners and visionaries and people that are inspired. And yeah, they want to do it their way. Cool. You know, I think the arguments start, you know, when you're arguing over over semantics, right? So my hope for Kenpo is that everybody gets to learn it correctly, right, the right way, and that they are inspired in their lives to continue to learn it, to hopefully teach it, but to allow there to be a difference of opinion, because we all have the ability to learn from each other, you know? I don't think that that's wrong. And I what I'm seeing now is a unification across patches, especially with my generation, the younger generations. They just want the art, you know? And rank is becoming less important to these people, and it is more of the love of it and the knowledge of it, you know? And again, going back to, okay, we're coming across a technique right now that isn't working. Why? Well, maybe there's a master key movement in there that wasn't taught, that my instructor didn't even know was there, right? You don't know what you don't know. And if it's the game of telephone going down the line all the way through the generations, technique's not going to work as well, right? Because you're missing that fraction of an inch, right? You're missing that waiter's check in, you know, the extension of twirling wings to help you take the guy down. If you don't have that, you're just smashing into him. You know, my dad pointed that out to me the other day. He's like, what are you doing? It's like a mosh pit in there. He's like, put your waiter check up, fuse it to your body, and now try it. I'm like, oh my gosh, thank you. Right? So I'd like to see some more humility, and I'd like to see some more curiosity in our instructors, you know?
Yeah. I agree 100% on that.
Like, just put it down, you know? Put it down and enjoy it. And drop those stances. Yes. I'm going to keep saying that.
Oh yeah, no, I'm going to start working on my stances. After
thank you. This. Yeah, Reggie, I want to see him.
Very nice. All right, so we're going to move into our lightning round here. So I got a few little questions here as we close in on our time tonight. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Favorite. Yeah, I do. Unfurling crane. Yep.
Nice. Very nice. Very nice. All right. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
I do. Stance set two, favorite set. I find it to be the equivalent of like yoga in the Kenpo. Really helps with the stances, the breathing, the connection, right, of the hands and feet, the upper and lower case, what the feet are doing, the hands are doing. It is a very meditative set for me. And I don't care about the arguments saying that it's not in the original system. Whatever. I love it. I'm going to do it. form. Form four, I will be a student of my entire life. Love that form. Recommend it to anybody that wants to just be better at endurance and your angles and being in the pattern, right? Excellent for that, and just an awesome fighting form. But now my new love is eight, I gotta say. Like, yeah, I'm learning so much more about the art by putting the knives in the hands. Yeah.
Very nice, very nice. So two things that got me thinking that you mentioned. Of course, I should have guessed Sansette. Sansette too. Just been talking about stances. That should have been a
Well,
given
plus you
for
get
me.
these like really cool, expansions and contractions in that form that just really give the whole body an opportunity to flex and expand and connect everything.
And then that also leads kind of into the second thing that I was thinking about doing things that aren't in the system. So the school that I started with, we did
Oh
book set,
yeah, book
and
set is amazing.
when I started at my current school, I was, I was bummed that I had to start over, but I was like, oh well, I'm gonna work my way back up, and I can't wait to get back to doing book set again. And my instructor's like, we don't do that here. And I was like, oh no. So I got in touch with my original teacher and got caught up and refreshed on book set, and so I still do it probably at least a couple of times a week. And
Good.
when the day comes when I have my own school, I'm teaching book set.
Please
I'm sorry
do.
people don't like it, but I'm gonna do it because that's one of my favorite
Well,
forms.
you
So.
talk about lineage. I mean, Parker drew a lot of our Chinese movements from book set. So just because he decided not to include it in the ranking system doesn't mean it wasn't foundationally important to the development of Kenpo and the way he articulated the universal pattern. So, do it. Thank you for doing it. Show
Yeah,
us.
no,
Show the
yeah,
people.
yeah. No, I'm doing book set, and when I get to learn Tiger and Crane, I'm doing
Oh,
that
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Well, so
If people don't like it, then
eight,
too bad.
right? The salute in eight is the nod and in the inclusion of the crane salute, right? The white crane, which was again something that wasn't carried all the way through, but he did show homage to it and importance to it, right? So they're there. They're there. Good for you.
Thank you. All right, and so our final question, if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Anyone that I would train with, fiction, alive or dead, John Wick.
Very nice.
That's a no-brainer.
Very
Yep,
nice,
John
very
Wick,
nice.
absolutely. Awesome. That'd be fun.
Yeah, no, I've just been blown. I kind of have a chuckle because when the first John Wick came out, like I didn't know anything about it, and as most people, what is this John Wick movie, whatever. And I didn't see it quite a ways after it was out, and I just never kind of heard about it. And then I think my brother was talking. I think the second one was about to come out. Or it just came out or something, and he kind of mentioned, and I was like, oh, like what is this John Wick movie? And I was like, Keanu Reeves, like
He's a
what's the deal?
Kenpoist.
And
Yeah.
oh, this
Yeah,
I
he's a
did not know.
Kenpoist.
Oh, okay. Well then,
I know the guy that
trying
trained
trying
him in the Kenpo. Yeah. Yeah.
oh, this is this is also something that I love about this and doing this and talking to people is finding out, and actually I need to also give a shout out to the Everyday Martial Artist podcast with Brian Doucette. Great podcast. He is platinum standard for
That's
podcasting,
awesome.
so, and he's a big inspiration for why I'm doing this. A lot of the people that he's interviewed, a lot of them have done Kenpo or started in Kenpo. Maybe they're not specifically known for it now, but I was really surprised at how many people have done Kenpo or trained it as one of their arts. And so I was like, oh man, like I really gotta talk to some people and find out who's who in the Kenpo world, and definitely get some light onto some of those that are kind of undercover Kenpo people. So You know, like, I mean, I remember going back, you know, for the longest time, you know, I didn't know Dan Asanto was, you know, Kenpo, you know, mm-hmm. Kenpo black belt, and it was like, oh, well, he's doing two-man set. And I was like, why is he doing that? It's like, oh, yeah, he was, you know, he was early Kenpo
second
guy,
favorite so. Set, by the way, so. Two-man set, right? Yeah, so
very
much
nice,
fun.
Very nice, mm-hmm. very nice. So, yeah, no, that's great. I like yeah. that. So yeah, no, I thank you so much for taking the time to chit-chat
well,
with
thank
me.
Thank you.
So, now is your time for a shameless self-promotion, so you can plug anything you want or say anything, cover anything that we didn't cover.
Oh, how cool.
And we will close out with
a salute.
Whatever, yeah.
Sure. I mean, if I get to plug something, I'm certainly going to plug the LT Kenpo app, not just because it's Dad's app, but because it rocks. I mean, it is such a wonderful tool for those moments when you're like, oh, I don't remember it, or the technique isn't working. Most recently, I was working on Glancing Salute, right? Like, how many of us get up the clock and then we're just having such a difficult time, right, with the glancing arm break, and went back to it, and I was like, oh yeah, it's because I'm actually supposed to step more to like 9:39. Now I'm going to turn to the forward bow. Oh, look at that, they moved. Great. So for those circumstances, I recommend it. And then for people that, you know, struggle with like the forms, a recent hack that I found to do with the app is to the phone and or whatever platform you're using, put it towards the mirror, right? So for those of us with dyslexia like me, who are like, okay, which arm is he using, like, why am I on the other side, just turn the phone into the mirror and learn it that way. You'll be just fine.
Oh, excellent. That's a great
yeah.
great step. So I'll have to utilize that. So yeah, no, thank you again. It's been a pleasure to chat, well, meet you and chat with you.
You too.
And congratulations on the recent promotion. Excited to see that and look forward to all your future accomplishments.
Thank
and
you.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do this again down the road and you know, find out what new things you're up to, and talk more about specific
sure.
topics.
Sure, anytime.
Yeah, no, thank you again.
Thank you, and there you go. And salute to you. Well done.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.